Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Bookdoll of chickflix.net.
Hannah, our beverage this evening, it's a stretch. It was hard. I don't know why it was so challenging.
I thought we'd find something easily, but it didn't happen this week.
I think this could apply to two, maybe one more than the other.
It's a beer out of Baltimore called Balls to the Wall, so I assume that's really meant to be a baseball metaphor.
Well, it's in Orioles colors.
But I would say it has something to do with our first big film, or not our first big film, our second film, The Kitchen.
I did tie it to The Kitchen because it's so out there and so random and so haphazard that it's balls to the wall. But if you had said The Art of Racing in the Rain, you wouldn't have been wrong, because I think you can. That's a metaphor you can say about racing. He's balls to the wall.
I suppose, but there is pretty much a direct reference in The Kitchen to these women having,
It's from Oliver Brewing Company. They are out of Baltimore. They say they have been brewing craft beer since 1993.
See, I can tell you're not from Baltimore because you say it wrong.
What, Oliver?
Baltimore.
Yeah, there's a T in Baltimore.
There's no T in Baltimore.
Well, I know you say it with a soft D, Baltimore.
Baltimore.
No, I am not from there. Our first film we usually start with the biggest film of the week, and this is not going to be the biggest film of the week. I don't want to start with that because I think our listening audience isn't really want the kids film to bat lead off, so it won't.
Oh, you think the kids film will take the lead?
Yeah, well, okay. It won't win the week. That'll probably be The Lion King, or maybe even Hobbs and Shaw. But we're going to start with the blockbuster novel adaptation of The Art of Racing in the Rain. Many of you listeners have probably read this. It came out in 2008, and it spent 156 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I did not read it.
I didn't read it either. In fact, I'd never heard of it.
I'd heard of it. It's directed by Simon Curtis. We know Simon Curtis. I loved Simon Curtis's 2011 film, My Week with Marilyn, where Michelle Williams played Marilyn Monroe. She was outstanding in that. And he moved on in 2015 to direct Helen Mirren in Woman in Gold. Ya boys in that. Ryan Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
And The Weeper. The Weeper from 2017 that destroyed my audience. Goodbye, Christopher Robin.
Yeah.
Destroyed my audience.
I can see the Goodbye, Christopher Robin stamp, I think, all over The Art of Racing in the Rain.
That's because it is a weeper. And it's also the third talking dog film this year after a dog's journey and a dog's way home. There's a dog talking to us. He's not like Beverly Hills Chihuahua or Marmaduke. He's an old soul. I called him a philosopher poet canine.
Golden retriever, I believe.
The trailer, the preview, the movie poster says, from the company that brought you Marley and Me, another weeper and another dog weeper. What I took from this is I'm going to go ahead and guess the novel was better because it's very episodic, and I think that comes across better in a novel and in chapter form. I got from this because it stars your boy, Milo Ventimiglia. This came across to me like a This Is Us episode, a longer feature film, season's worth of drama, This Is Us season in one film.
Have you really watched This Is Us?
Yes, one full season and two episodes of the second season.
You got to get further along than that, because I do watch This Is Us, and I do love Milo. And Milo, to me, in this film, is very similar in appeal to his Jack character from This Is Us. But this film is... He plays a race car driver who adopts this puppy and he names him Enzo.
Why does he name him Enzo?
After Enzo Ferrari, the car maker out of Italy. And so it's a very fitting name. And Milo is, his character, what is his character's name? I can't even remember.
Denny Swift.
Denny Swift. I love how Denny Swift is a race car driver.
It's nominative determinism.
Exactly. But, he's sort of this aspiring Formula One race car driver who works in a auto body shop to make ends meet. And he adopts this puppy one day. And so basically, we're kind of seeing Denny's life through the eyes of Enzo over the years after he's adopted. And this film, in the first 1 minute, sets you up to cry. It just does. It just starts and you're like, oh no, this is going to be just kind of a tough watch potentially for animal lovers. But then it takes an interesting turn where it's really not so much about the health of the dog so much as the health of the woman that Denny ends up meeting, falling in love with, marrying, and having a child with. And that's, you know, really there's a subplot involved that to me took this film a bit off the rails, off track, and just made it not so much just sort of melancholy and sad, but I didn't buy into a custody fight that ends up happening between Denny and his late wife's parents.
You giving that away?
It's not a spoiler because this movie is going to be watched by the people who've already read the book. Most of the people that were in the audience at the screening I saw had read this book, saw it, went to this screening because they'd read the book, and were curious to see how it would compare and how it would translate. Most said it was pretty faithful to the book, but I'm hearing that there is actually one additional subplot that does not exist in the film, and I'm glad for that. So I'm a sucker for a weeper, and I did see a dog's journey, and you know, the dog in this is voiced by Kevin Costner. I mean, how can you go wrong? You've got Milo Ventimiglia, and the voice of Kevin Costner is a philosophical golden retriever who's just really just adorable. And regardless of the rest of the film, it's a tug at your heartstrings kind of film that the same people who watched A Dog's Journey, A Dog's Purpose, Marley and Me, and A Dog's Way Home, this movie is for them, and it's going to be avoided by the same people who always avoid a dog movie.
This movie it piles on the drama, the melodrama, so much, especially with that subplot you didn't care for, and I really didn't care for. It has a hint of Lifetime Channel, Hallmark, Hall of Fame.
Yes.
The smartest character in the book is Enzo the dog. He is by far more omniscient than anybody else. He catches on to what's going on before anybody, and he talks in these really long polysyllabic words and talks about a documentary on Mongolia. And he's just, the way he talks, like, call it fate, call it luck, all I know, I was destined to be his dog. He was a race car driver the way I was a dog. And he talks in these rhetorical, I mean, it's Socrates talking
well,
to me.
Because
it's Plato.
He draws all these he basically, life as a metaphor as it relates to race car driving, because that's all he knows. That's the life that he has lived with Denny, being consumed by an obsession with race car driving and a love of race car driving. And so he relates so many things in life to what you learn on the track and to become a good driver. And so, it's Kevin Costner. And so you almost get that same sort of pacing and emotive quality that, you know, when he's doing voiceover in Field of Dreams, you know, it's Kevin Costner. And so I do think that the casting was probably the smartest part of this film in terms of Milo and Kevin Costner. The love interest, the wife, is played by Amanda Seyfried, who has done her share of sort of these melodramatic films like, you know, Dear John. I remember she was in with my boy.
Channing Tatum.
And, you know, and she's done her more lighter stuff too, Mamma Mia. But she doesn't really have all that much to do in this film. And the casting of her parents, I felt definitely was Lifetime movie-esque.
Yeah, they're character actors. That's Martin Donovan. Yeah. I remember him from Weeds. And that's Kathy Baker. I think she's got an Emmy under her belt.
Yeah, I remember her. I think she was in this movie, this series Picket Fences that I really
liked. She was
in
Picket Fences.
Yeah, so I do. I liked her. But to me, they feel like TV movie characters. And that, again, the subplot involving them, I just didn't buy into, because you like Denny. There's no way you cannot just be rooting for Denny and Enzo throughout this film. And there's a little bit, there's a scene involving the dog Enzo that I also just felt like was not, didn't make sense to me.
Well, it almost sounds like
hole.
You were responding to the movie pushing you where it wanted you to go.
Exactly. It is extremely intentionally manipulative, and it's in such a way that I still will always kind of be okay with watching a tearjerker. As long as it doesn't get bloody and violent, which this one does not. But there have been far better dog movies out there. But this, yeah, you are right in the fact that This Is Us, you know, I think the This Is Us demographic will probably appreciate this as a placeholder until the new season of This Is Us gets underway.
Did you notice? The way we talk to our pets, our cats, our dogs, is in baby talk. Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? Who wants a treat? Who wants to go outside? Denny and Eve, the wife, talk to Enzo like he's a human being. Enzo, what you see here, or what are we going to do? Actually, like, full complete sentences starting with Enzo and ending with, like, a period. And like, okay, I
don't know. I know some people who do talk to their pets in a more adult fashion. And the reason that these movies do appeal on a certain level is that every pet owner can relate to, what are you thinking? Like, staring into your pet's eyes and going, there's something going on behind those eyes, and you know exactly what you're doing. You know exactly what I'm thinking. You know what you did wrong. You know when you did right. And so that's really where that bond, that human pet bond that so many people just are drawn to and can relate to. That's what this film is ultimately about, and so for that it's sweet. I just felt that it took some turns that I did not like, but overall, especially one good thing with seeing so many films in a given week is it makes me actually kind of alter my perspective a little bit on things that I might have seen earlier after I've seen additional films.
All right, our next film is I Went Solo Because I Had the Kid. You did not go, and man, you missed out on quite a eventful screening, but we'll actually just stick to the film itself. I'm talking about Dora and the Lost City of Gold. I did not watch Dora the Explorer because I was already in college when it premiered, and it was Nickelodeon. It was really that early 2000 sweet spot, 2000, 2008. I believe it's still on television, but we do not watch it. This is live action, and Dora is no longer 6. She's 16. And it's directed by James Bobin. We know him because he's the guy who rebooted The Muppets. In 2011, he had Jason Segel and Amy Adams hang out with a whole bunch of Muppets. And he did it again in 2014 for the one I liked better, Muppets Most Wanted. He is a guy who pokes fun at his subjects. He doesn't, like, mock them, but he gets the joke. He did that. You can do that with The Muppets. And he did that on his TV shows that he came up with. The Ali G Show with early Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, yes.
He did it with Flight of the Conchords. Remember, the Muppets won an Oscar for best song. So he's got Dora now, and he's got a new, not new, she was in a movie already, but Isabelle Monnaire is playing Dora. You know her from Instant Family. She was the eldest foster child in that film.
Oh, okay.
And you can't have Dora, I guess, without a Diego. Diego is Jeff Wahlberg. Do you recognize that last name?
I recognize
Jeff
the Wahlberg. Last name.
That's because he's a nephew of Marky Mark and Donnie. Marky Mark and Donnie, Jeff Wahlberg. What I took away from Dora, which is different from what a six-year-old will take away, all the parents will take away, is the amount, the plethora, the quantity of fart jokes. A huge amount. There's a song. Apparently Dora sings all the time and makes up songs on the spot that relate to the plot. She does that here with pooping. There's a song about pooping. This is a kids level adventure. I called it like Training Wheels Goonies. It's an introductory Indiana Jones. There's an homage to Last Crusade in there. It's a jungle adventure. There's no stakes. There are no action scenes that will quicken your pulse. There are no mystery puzzles to solve that are really overly more complicated than a beginner's Sudoku. The big takeaway is explorers are good. If you find something, that's the treasure. Treasure hunters are bad because they they steal, they disrupt, and they do not value the meaning of friendship.
That seems like an awfully, negative blanket statement. I mean, there are no good treasure hunters
out
there.
No, you want to be an archaeologist, you want to be an explorer, and you want to see it, but then you want to leave it alone. Don't take it. So Indiana Jones technically was a treasure
pirate
hunter.
Exactly, and all those pirate movies where, you find your pot of gold and...
Dora grows up in the jungle, in this, like, Jungle McMansion with parents Michael Pena and Eva Longoria.
Oh, okay.
And they realize by the time when she's 16, she doesn't have, what you say, the social skills. So naturally, they
like
send
Tarzan.
Her...
Like Tarzan?
Yeah. Remember how Tarzan was a fish out of water when he went to London? They send her to Los Angeles, naturally, to high school, where she does not, she does not fit in to the high school. But I want to talk about Isabelle Monnier for a second. She is... very good. She takes this seriously. She always, I guess she has to have an omnipresent smile on her face and an always a can-do attitude. There are other high schoolers and friends that come along because they all get kidnapped, taken back to the jungle in Peru, looking for the lost Incan city of gold. Yada, yada, yada. It doesn't matter. Just know, if you as a parent get dragged to this, she's good. She's worth watching. We will see more of her. The story is ridiculous. The plot, the bad guys, it means nothing. There's Boots the monkey. There's Swiper the fox. It all means nothing. I personally did not like this, but the kids did. And knowing Hannah, she'll say, "Well, that's all that
it is." It is. I always look to what the reaction from the kids is when I'm coming out of a kids' movie. It's the same thing with The Lion King. I think the kids appreciated it and liked it way more than the adults did. And so, sometimes when that's who it's made for, and it's made to be decent enough for the adults to be okay with tagging along, but good enough for the kids to enjoy it and for it to have a positive message for the kids. And it sounds like overall that any kind of Dora movie, because I do remember that the series on TV, it was trying to get kids into geography, and so it's a good thing. And so if it's got a positive message and the kids enjoy it, fart jokes aside.
No, all fart jokes. All fart jokes.
Well, then even Lion King had a fart joke, remember? And that's where all the kids were laughing. So.
All kids' movies have a fart joke.
Well, obviously it's summertime.
Well, it's going to have to build a new audience. The audience that grew up with Dora, they're too old for this movie.
That's what I was thinking.
And they're not going to go.
Right.
And they wouldn't like it. So this is going to have to get kids who are watching her now, experiencing her for the first time, or saying, okay, I can dig this. But yeah, the core audience, already gone, already aged
That's
out.
What I was thought. That's why I'm surprised that you think it's going to be the top movie. But
I don't think it will. I think Lion King will. But out of all the new releases this week, of which
releases,
there are many, many, many,
yeah,
Dora will win.
Okay.
And that scary movie we didn't see, Scary Stories,
right.
We did something, that might give it a run for its money.
All
right, our next film
better not win the week
it's just a head scratcher, and I'll set you up so you can, I want to hear you, because you rarely do this, and I know, so I want to hear what's coming, so I'm going to set you up. But we're talking about The Kitchen, and The Kitchen is female driven crime drama. We're talking three heavy hitting actresses: Melissa McCarthy, Oscar nominated Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, blown up the comedy scene, now dipping her toe into her first dramatic performance, and Elizabeth Moss, Emmy winner, Golden Globe winner, Elizabeth Moss. 1978, Hell's Kitchen. I learned a lot about Hell's Kitchen. I didn't know exactly where in Manhattan it was. Now I know. And I know that its roots are poor and Irish. 1978 also was, a terrible year to live in Hell's Kitchen, because the sanitation guys never emptied the trash. They were always full. From Andrea Berloff. This is her first time directing, but she's no stranger. She wrote Oliver Stone's 2006 World Trade Center, if you remember that one from
that
way back.
That was pretty good.
And more recent, she wrote Straight Outta Compton.
Mm-hmm.
Great film.
Pretty good.
Great script. Phenomenal cast. Can't miss, right?
You would think. And yet. It does.
Ooh.
I mean, I've so wanted to support this because it is. It's female-led. It's got this trio of talented women. But in the end, what happened was, and it started off in a very strong way for me. I really thought I was going to like these women. It's the, you've got the women play the wives of these three Irish mobsters who run some sort of protection racket in Hell's Kitchen. And the husbands end up getting busted by the feds and going to prison. And so while they're in prison, the women decide, you know what, we're as qualified as anybody to take this on, and we need to make ends meet, and we need the cash. And the other guys who are part of this racket, you know, don't really know what they're doing. They're cutting us out of the cash too much. So they kind of take over the protection racket and try and expand it out beyond the walls of Hell's Kitchen. And so that was all well and good initially, because you're like, wow, these chicks kick ass and they're smarter about it. And they're gonna sort of take over this, you know, slice of the mob kind of operation and do it in a different sort of way. And then it takes this turn, and it just is just violent, and I didn't like the women anymore. You've got these great men, too. This is an ensemble cast of women and men that is really, really good. But the story wasn't doing it for me midway through. The character arcs and the narrative just somewhere in the middle just fell off the rails, and I did not like it anymore. And so by the end, I could not get out of the kitchen fast enough.
The kitchen is insane. And not in a good way. Sometimes when I say films are insane, I'm like, oh, it's insane. No, this is insane as in it's sloppy. It's severely poorly edited, especially as the scenes go back to back to back. That got very soap operatic. And the audience started laughing. I guarantee you, Andrea Berloff did not aim for laughs. And the audience was mocking the film. They were laughing at it and snickering, especially by some of the terrible dialogue. You know, it's the standard themes. There's no place for us out there. I'm tired of getting knocked around. And then Donal Gleason shows up. The hitman. The muscle. He teaches them how to dismember bodies with a bone saw and a bathtub and float them down the river, which keeps coming up over and over again. Apparently, this was filmed in East Harlem and the South Bronx, which most closely resembled 1978 Hell's Kitchen. The production design is phenomenal. The clothes, the cars, the buildings, the slime, the dirt. I got a lot out of it. I thought it was very authentic.
Sure, even the performances.
Now, let me talk about the performance. Everybody who's talking about the performances, they agree that Tiffany Haddish is wooden. It's her first dramatic performance. She's reading her
lines.
But
you know what? I don't think it's not her first dramatic performance. She's been inching towards trying to dabble in the drama in several other roles since Girls Trip, since her breakout comedic performance in Girls Trip. And so I saw her last year in this satire called The Oath. And she was a very stripped down portrayal kind of character. And to me, she was much better in that. And so with this, it looked like it kind of shifted from scene to scene with whether she was trying to be comedic Tiffany Haddish or trying to be ultra dramatic Tiffany Haddish. And I just don't think it worked for her. Elizabeth Moss, however, kills it.
When people praise an acting performance in this film, they're praising Melissa McCarthy. I am not. I disagree.
No, I think Elizabeth Moss.
I am throwing my weight behind Elizabeth Moss.
Me too.
This girl acts anybody else off the screen with her. She owns every scene. She has no business being this good in a film this bad. I mean, she is Best Supporting Actress nomination worthy, in my opinion. Terrible film. Good Lord, Elizabeth Moss, what were you doing that was so good?
No, I absolutely agree that to me, even the way I looked at it was, even Elizabeth Moss's performance could not save this film.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she had me nailed to my seat. I was so tired of this film. It's not even the long film. It's 102 minutes. It's nothing. It felt a lot longer.
It did.
It was just so, it's just poorly done. It's amateur hour. I can't believe they got this cast. It must read better on paper.
There's something. And I guess it's based on, I'd never heard of this Vertigo comic book series.
So DC, you know DC, that's Batman, that's Superman. They have a subline, a separate line called DC Vertigo for more adult fare. There's a laundry list of stuff you are familiar with, but this is a miniseries that is one of them, DC Vertigo.
Well, I don't think it translated very well in this case.
It really didn't. It's a terrible, terrible film.
And I'll just make a quick note that Artie Chick for ChickFlix.net happened to review some other film, an Italian gangster movie called Piranhas, that's also out there for the artsy crowd this week. And she seemed to definitely didn't think it was a great film, but it sounded to me, just based on her review, that if you want a gangster movie, it's better with teenagers in Italy, it's better than The Kitchen.
Well, my solo movie was Dora. You went solo on a movie this week. From the movie poster, it looks like handcuffs and football. What did you see?
That pretty much is. I saw a film called Brian Banks. And that's because I tend to be drawn to those films that are based on true stories and inspired by, you know, these true events. And it also, I saw that it had Greg Kinnear in it. And I adore Greg Kinnear. He just, you know, he's just always, to me, just an endearing character, actor. And so, once again, that is exactly what he is in this film. But this film is based on the story of this guy named Brian Banks, real dude, who was a star athlete in high school, like 16 years old, football player, with a full ride ahead of a full scholarship expected to USC, Pete Carroll. And then he gets falsely accused of rape when he's sort of just kind of messing around with another student, and it's mutual, it's consensual, and they actually don't even have relations. And so the fact that he was able to be falsely accused, and then there's a lawyer who kind of talks him into accepting a no-contest plea deal, saying that that's the only way he's going to avoid prison because nobody's going to believe that he did not rape this woman. And so he ends up going to prison for 5 years, then gets out and is on very strict parole for like another 5 years. And he can't get, it's, you know, really difficult to get a job, difficult to have to date anybody. You're a registered sex offender. And he decides, you know what, I'm still in prison. I'm on parole, and yet my life is not my own. I can't pursue my dream of being in the NFL. And so he goes and he seeks out the founder of the California Innocence Project, played by Greg Kinnear, and basically just begs him, you've got to help me clear my name. You have to help get my record cleared. I need to get this conviction vacated. And Greg Kinnear's character is like, dude, you know, we have to fight for all these people who are actually still in prison. You're out. Just ride out your parole and just sort of, you know, kind of understand that we just can't save everybody and help everybody. But this guy has a very convincing argument. He's really able to show that he's obviously, definitely innocent. And other people from the Innocence Project are like, you know, we all want to help. We want to make a difference in this guy's life. And so they all kind of circle around and go and sure enough, clear this guy's name. And so it's a passion project kind of movie. I don't feel like anybody needs to run out and see this one on the big screen. I think it's you know, it's just one of those ones that's really meant to just be like, oh my gosh, it gets a little preachy with the our justice system is broken and what will it take? And we all have a responsibility to kind of try and fix it and have, criminal justice reform. And even Morgan Freeman has an uncredited role in this. And I suspect that it became uncredited because it was probably being put together. This film was probably being done right around the same time that Morgan Freeman was kind of in the midst of some little Me Too controversy. And I suspect that's why, because of the nature of this film, that he ends up uncredited in this role. But, you know, he's dispensing pearls of wisdom and becomes sort of a mentor in prison to Brian Banks, and something that he kind of hangs his hat on to sort of come out of prison and make sure that he can try and reclaim his life. And so, you know, it's Aldous Hodge, who we saw in What Men Want and Hidden Figures, he plays Brian Banks. And, you know, he's okay, but this is just, there's some really, like, weak reenactments. And Brian Banks, I think, was a producer on this film, and he and the Innocence Project guy, Justin Hodge, I think was his name, were both on, you know, on set a lot of the time. And I'm not sure that necessarily did this film any favors, because there are just some things that just don't quite work very well. But in the end, it's, you know, it's just meant to be one of those biographical dramas that has some flaws, but has some feels too.
I'm glad this is your genre, because this is probably one of my least favorite genres. I don't like fictionalized, overly dramatic portrayals of real life events that I kind of already know what happened. I just shy away from that. I want nothing to do with it.
I didn't know this story, though. And then I realized the reason I really didn't know this story is because they make it sound like more like one of those, like The Blind Side, where you have this true story about how this guy then comes, you know, makes it in the NFL. They make it sound like this guy makes it in the NFL, but in the end, it doesn't go that far into what his career and what happens after he kind of gets his conviction vacated. It's in reality, I looked it up, and he played like a couple of preseason games in the NFL and never really played for actually during the season.
Well, he was probably out.
He was too old.
Yeah, he was out of commission in his prime years.
Yeah, I mean, there's some sweet moments where they talk about how, like, Pete Carroll gave him a shot at coming to training camp with the Seattle Seahawks, and then he ended up signing a little bit with the Atlanta Falcons. So people who are familiar with football and familiar with the teams he might have played on.
You're using a Seattle Seahawks coaster.
Oh, look at that. So I am. and so, you know, I think they're the only ones that will really necessarily know Brian Banks' story to some degree. I was not aware of it, but it just makes you, it's just one of those films that is designed and in the end makes you really mad about the justice system, makes you want to contribute to the Innocence Project, makes you really happy that organizations like the Innocence Project actually exist and continue to fight for people that have been screwed over by the justice system.
Well, if you're paying attention this week to the new releases and movie theaters and movie times, you'll notice there's a glut this week. There's been a drought the past, like, 3 weeks, one new release per week. And this week, we got throttled. We had to pick and choose very selectively what we were going to watch. And the reason we picked our next film, Tel Aviv on Fire, is because we noticed that we had a trend every year we seem to talk about like 3 to 4 Hebrew films, Jewish films, Israeli films, and this one's not exactly that. It takes place in Jerusalem and the West Bank, Ramallah, but
and it's directed by a Palestinian.
Yeah, so it's not a Hebrew Israeli film, but there's Hebrew in it, yeah. And if the cast mirrors the characters, it's half Israeli and half, well, it's actually 30-70. It's 30 Israeli, 70 Palestinian. Yeah. So we chose to watch Tel Aviv on Fire, and I was shocked, I tell you, to see that this won the Golden Space Needle Award, the best film at the Seattle Film Festival. I know this film festival very well, and I was shocked that this won. It's not a bad film, but it's not a great film either. It's quirky. You don't expect quirk to come out of Jerusalem and the West Bank, but we're talking about a soap opera here. We're talking about Salam. Kais Nashif plays Salam, and he's our guy. He's in every scene. He carries us through, and he's shifty. Like when you first see him, he's unemployed. You think he's had probably made poor choices, but he gets a job at his uncle's soap opera, translating. Then he weasels his way into becoming a writer, and he doesn't know how to write, so he gets help from a border guard captain, an Israeli captain manning a checkpoint between the West Bank and Jerusalem, not the place you really want to hang out. And they establish this kind of, sort of, I'll tolerate you relationship, where the captain's giving him, let me strengthen your Israeli character, because the show takes place in 67, the Six-Day War. I love the female's name on the soap opera. Her name is Rahel Ashkenazi.
Rahel.
The perfect no, Jewish name.
Well, that's just it. That everything is mellow. Everything is hyper dramatized because it's, yeah. So it's a modern day story. So basically, you have this modern day setting with a soap opera that's being filmed in, you know, on the Palestinian side in Ramallah with called Tel Aviv on Fire. And so it is a, it's got Arab backers. And so, you know, they've got an idea about how they want this season of this soap opera to play out. And it really is about this, this spy, this Palestinian spy who then is instructed to seduce a Israeli general in the months leading up to the Six-Day War. And so it's being, you know, they're looking back at the Israeli and Arab perspective on what was happening in that time period just before the Six-Day War. And so it's the only way. I really love that they have this, this using a soap opera, which is over-dramatized intentionally in its nature, to allow the filmmaker to tackle these very serious issues in a way that goes down easier on both sides, because the soap opera is watched by Israelis and by the Jews and the Arabs. And that's where they all have their own ideas about how these characters should develop and how it should end. And yeah, they, because it's the Palestinians who are writing it and directing and producing it, yes, there, it's like, okay, our Jewish character, Rachel Ashkenazi, it's like, can you come up with a more Jewish-sounding name? And then you've got the Israeli border guy saying, your portrayal of the Israeli general is just so off, and here's really how you guys need to play that character, and my wife watches the show, and so here's what you need to do to make sure that my wife knows that I know the writer on this soap opera, and she's going to think I'm just, she's just going to be so excited that I know somebody on this soap. And so he kind of blackmails Salam to sort of take his ideas and include them in the soap. But then he ends up just kind of stuck that, you know, how do you end this season? And what's going to happen, and how is everybody going to accept the ending? And what's really cool is that the movie audience is kept in the dark the same way the soap opera audience is about how that final show, that final scene is going to play out.
A lot of Tel Aviv on Fire is farce. It's farcical, mm-hmm. because they have to set this up in a particular way to make it work. But what I did like was, I'll call it checkpoint reality. This actually shows the really frustrating atmosphere that Palestinians, they call it the occupation, what they're going through, what they have to do with, live within their daily lives. He gets in a fight with the border captain. You know, he's saying Marwin, the Palestinian guy controlling the spy, he's a freedom fighter, while the Israeli calls him a terrorist. Mm-hmm. And then the captain gets into it with his wife. He's like, this show is anti-Semitic. And she says, no, it's romantic. You wouldn't understand. So it strains their marriage. And he actually begins to come off as kind of a villain, I think more villainous than they intended to. He does something, he kidnaps, there's a kidnapping, there's a gun scene.
It shifts, it doesn't though. Work. It shifts back and forth.
The tone fell apart.
But it got back, it came back. I think it circled back to the right place to where ultimately I thought this film was very thought-provoking and amusing, which is a very difficult thing to accomplish when you're dealing with Israeli-Palestinian relations.
Yeah, I was middling on it. I see you definitely liked it better than I did.
Well, and I watched General Hospital. You know, I DVR soap, so it's like I've always liked soap, so to have this kind of... I was able to, I think, enjoy what they were doing behind the scenes a little more, because I just, same reason I like This Is Us.
So what are we looking at next week?
Next week is another one where there's too much, because I've got my brother's wedding to attend, so I'm only going to... next week we have Good Boys, which I believe we are both going to.
Yep.
That one looks really fun. I'm ready for a fun, raunchy movie. I think it's the same people who did... did they do Superbad? They did that one with the talking food.
Sausage Party.
I think they did Sausage Party.
I haven't looked ahead, but what I noticed was it looks like an even younger R-rated Superbad.
Yes, it does. And then the other one I definitely, we saw already, and we'll talk about Blinded by the Light, based on a book that was inspired by the music of Springsteen.
The Boss.
The Boss. There's the Angry Birds movie too, which I think we're both skipping.
Saw the first one. I'm not going.
No, and I'm not going either. One Child Nation, I heard is very good, but
I don't know
not
if I have
sure.
a chance.
And hoping for an After the Wedding, maybe.
Maybe.
We'll see. And Where Did You Go, Bernadette is the one that I'm missing the screening that I really actually would have liked to see. It looks, that one looks kind of fun for, you know, a chick flick. But I think between Good Boys and Blinded by the Light, I'm actually kind of looking forward to next week.
Well, quick recap of this week. The Art of Racing in the Rain was way too just soapy and soppy for me. I didn't point out that it wasn't supposed to be Milo's film. It was supposed to be made many years ago, and it was supposed to star your boy, Patrick Dempsey.
Real, and I can totally see that. I can absolutely see that. They were sort of interchangeable in their times. And so, yes, Patrick Dempsey as the hot doc from Grey's Anatomy when he was still on that show would have been a good choice. But Milo is the it guy right now. It boils down to, if you like those dog movies, here's another one for you. It manipulates you emotionally, knows exactly what it's doing. But if you're looking for a weeper, here's your one.
Dora and the Lost City of Gold is not like a Toy Story. Both kids and adults will not take anything away from it and enjoy it together. This is only for your kids.
The kitchen stinks.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's all I can tell
you. The kitchen is just rotten filth garbage.
Just
is what
stay
it
out
is.
Of the kitchen.
Brian Banks.
Brian Banks, just maybe if you're into those true stories about inspirational football stuff and true crime justice stuff. But I don't think you can wait and stream it down the line.
Tel Aviv on Fire just got lucky this week. It is the week's best film because I found most everything else limiting. But even I didn't really like it.
I really liked it. That was just one of those ones that absolutely I found pleasantly surprising. I'm generally not a art house foreign film buff, but this is one that, yes, I think floats to the top of my favorite movie of the week, followed by The Art of Racing in the Rain just because of Milo and a cute dog voice by Kevin Costner.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.